December, Wednesday, December the 9th, to the Port of Port Townsend order. And today we have one thing on the agenda, the capital repair and replacement plan, which we have this.
Small document. Two pages, two sided. Now this, we've been, a lot of work has gone into this, and I want to especially thank Eric, who's done most of the wording, Harold, our engineer, who surveyed all the properties, and Larry Ozzy, who's been in to help with the prioritization and kind of double check and make sure we didn't get too far off track. So I think we need to go through it. This is the first draft. Since there might be some changes come out of this session that we want to make, we haven't put on the website yet. Our intent is to get up on the website this afternoon. We made 10 color copies. There's only, I think, two out in the audience. There was such an expense going to apply change again. But it will be on the website, hopefully by the end of the day. So with that, Eric, I'd like to turn it over to you for presenting it.
Sure. Well, let me just take the biggest possible big picture view here as to what we were hoping to accomplish with this. And describe a little bit what this is and what it isn't. It focuses exclusively on repair and replacement of existing capital infrastructure. It does not focus on new capital projects. So new port initiatives, for instance, to expand existing facilities or to try to generate jobs through additional economic development, for instance, the long discussed airport-like industrial park, those things are not addressed within this document. This is in recognition of the port's limited financial capabilities currently and the need to get a really good handle on shoring up core infrastructure that supports the services and the jobs that the port currently provides and accommodates. So the approach in developing this plan was really simple, and I think we discussed this at a couple of workshops earlier this year. It was first to retain the services of a qualified professional engineer, and we did so with Harold Anderson, formerly of Quadra Engineering, and he's been a real pleasure to work with and a consummate professional. And his task was to go through facility by facility and identify our capital repair and replacement needs, not our wants, but the things that we needed to do within the near term to make sure that our facilities were maintained in a state of good repair. His second task was then to accurately, at least to the greatest degree of accuracy possible at this level of planning, estimate the cost to undertake the necessary projects. And what we did in this regard is Harold used some cost estimating software, RS Means software, to help with that exercise. And we also used recent bids that we had on similar projects and updated those numbers for inflation. So after identifying the repair and replacement needs and estimating the cost to the best of our ability, we met as a staff and used the matrix that was developed, I believe, last year for maintenance projects to help us prioritize the projects. This was a way that we thought we could help give voice to the strategic plan policy direction that is the port's governing policy documents. So in all, we identified, I think it's 43 projects, and went through that prioritization process. I think we achieved a high degree of agreement at a staff level as to the project priorities. I should add a footnote in this respect. When you look at this plan and you see the 43 projects outlined in master table that you find in the document. I would caution you not to read too much into the priorities as we get lower down the list, because a lot of projects scored very closely or scored the same. And so they're listed by number, but that isn't necessarily really reflecting a recommended order of priority after you get past, for instance, the first 13 or so projects, where we feel that there is enough to differentiate these projects. So we identified essentially three priorities. Priority one projects, which are kind of the highest, most urgent priorities, kind of core infrastructure that we feel that we need to find a way to address in the near term. And then priority two and three projects. I think it's reasonable to expect both the public and the commission to have some opinions that might vary from those of staff, and this is very much a draft. I think you will find, particularly as you get into the priority two projects, the top of those priority two projects, there are some projects that I think where, again, reasonable minds could differ, and you might might conclude that some of those need to be elevated in priority. And finally, we had a whole raft of priority three projects, which really didn't score very, very highly at all. They are necessary in the medium term, say the next 12 plus years to undertake. But we have quite enough on our plate with the priority one projects that we have identified. And I should say that those projects, as we have currently outlined them, and I would call your attention that it's easiest to look at this in the master table, which begins on page 20. Those priority one projects that we've identified total just under $13 million, and these are projects that we think we need to find a way to undertake within the next 6 years, basically the life of this initial plan. And then we have a total of $2 million in priority two projects, and roughly $1.5 million in priority three projects. So the total identified need port-wide is just north of $16 million. And we think with the right mix of approaches to both cutting administrative costs and achieving other cost efficiencies within the port, as well as revisiting rates and fees, and potentially taking the 1% rather than banking it in terms of the property tax levy on an annual basis, along with grant funding sources and other funding sources that we at least hypothetically have laid out a path where we think we can fund all of the priority one projects. But it's no small undertaking. You will find that there are kind of different categories of projects that are outlined here. Some are really high priority, kind of immediate term projects necessary to avoid a red tag situation. There actually is only one of those. It's one that you're acutely aware of already, and that's the basically the sail loft building down at Point Hudson, where following recent inspections, the city has basically concluded that we need to undertake some fire safety repairs as soon as we're able to kind of shore up that facility. The second category, other than red tag, is just capital repair projects. These are just kind of the larger scale repair projects. They go kind of beyond what we would address within the normal operations budget through port maintenance staff. These are projects that we would capitalize that would be, in the instance of this plan, $25,000 or greater in estimated cost. And then finally, there are the really big ticket items, and those are the capital replacement projects. And the one that kind of stands above all others here that you, again, you're very much aware of is the Point Hudson jetty project. So what we've done is tried to outline in kind of the most straightforward manner possible. Number one, what we need to do to attain a state of good repair. Number two, what is it going to cost to do that? Number three, how would we recommend the projects be prioritized consistent with your adopted policy? And four, how do we propose that we begin to find a path forward to pay for these most necessary projects? I'm happy to go into greater detail, and we can walk you through this document kind of section by section and talk a little bit about what each section contains, but I think for an initial overview, that's about all I would say.
As far as the prioritization, a number of us went through with the matrix and scored on them. It's all subjective. You know, one person will think something more important than another. But the detail is Appendix C, I think it is,
yes,
for each of the projects. So you can see exactly how it's scored on the matrix. And the only, there's a couple of tweaks because we wanted to make sure we had this ready for today, that on page 4 on the pie chart, it was difficult to change that graph because of the software, but where it says sale of buildings, I would change that to properties. At some point from a strategic standpoint, we may want to rid ourselves of non-built up areas that we own that aren't producing anything, so.
You know, if I could add, maybe throw one more fly into the ointment here, and that relates to the future and the very uncertain nature of the future, particularly as it relates to just how vulnerable port facilities are to the mounting costs and consequences of climate change in the coming century. We have an awful lot of low-lying infrastructure. And while we don't believe that within the next 6 years or so that these facilities will necessarily be jeopardized, the best available science suggests that they certainly will be in coming decades. And the port will face, I think, some very difficult decisions, really involving kind of determining the point at which the cost of repairing infrastructure after environmental damage outweighs the benefits derived from those expenditures. So I'm not suggesting that that's something that's imminent or that we need to do in the next 6 years, but when you're making investments in capital infrastructure that are, in some instances will last a generation, these are considerations that should be in mind.
And there's some graphs on the pictures on 11 and 12 that kind of show the inundation areas that are projected by FEMA and other agencies. Essentially, the Boat Haven and the Point Hudson are gone.
And so it's hard to read that legend. What's the time frame on the flood risk?
I think, this is really indefinite in this one. I think this was projecting out to showing kind of the low severity and high severity risk at century's end based on different scenarios within the IPCC's fifth assessment report. So it's, I think there's some updated mapping information that I would suggest be included here in lieu of these. I think the final version of the report
this, this goes up to 2060.
Yeah, okay, 2060. So, so again, and they're based on different emission scenarios.
You know, if you say replace some new docks, you know, we can probably get 30 or 40 years out of them, but would you then replace them again at the end of that period if in fact this is becoming true? And the other thing, although this says 2060, you know, there's a wide spectrum of the impact that you'll be seeing, in that it's not going to all happen on day one at 2060. You know, it's going to be a gradual increase, and then the storm events, you know, because of the higher water levels, et cetera. So 10, 15, 20, 25 years before that, you'll actually be impacted.
So this is the most recent information. It's dated 2014. It hasn't been updated since then?
Well, these scenarios have not been updated. Again, these are based on IPCC fifth assessment report, basically kind of taken by a consulting team. And this was for the climate change on the Olympic Peninsula.
I'm sorry, IPCC?
Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is the UN-sponsored body that comes up with the kind of the consensus science that is intended to guide government decision making globally.
George.
The documents you're looking at, are the maps that you see there, are from the Washington Sea Grant study. And in terms of update, yes, this was in 2014 that this came out. But the Hood Canal Coordinating Council had a meeting in Bremerton, I believe it was something like 4 months ago. And the thrust of the whole meeting was that the computer models are actually conservative. It's happening much faster than the computer models. So I just throw that out there.
Just take into account subduction and rising of the land mass?
That was taken into account I gotta just find it and read it to you because it's a mouthful and there's a reason why I can't remember.
It's somewhat of a inaccurate science, although it's going to happen. It's because Puget Sound, with all of our plates and fault lines, like Olympia, even if there were no sea level rise, Olympia is going to be inundated because that whole area is subsiding. As the Olympic Peninsula tilts.
So we'll find this at the bottom of pages 8 and the top of page 9. It's the North Olympic Peninsula Resource Conservation and Development Council's project planning for climate change on the North Olympic Peninsula, which was released in September of this year. Not to just fill the void with the sound of my own voice here, but one of the things I want to stress is that what Harold did was try to outline the projects that we need to undertake kind of in the near to medium term to maintain a state of good repair. And we have outlined a path where, in theory, with certain tweaks to our own operations and budgeting here, that we can find a way to pay for about 12.1 million of the 16 million plus in projects that we've identified. So that would leave, even with certain changes that we might make to port budgets, about 4 million plus in deferred maintenance needs.
So this is all, would you mind going over those, that path that you just referred to?
Well, I think the easiest way to do it is to just look at the executive summary. What page? I'll find it here just a second.
What's page one?
This is on page 3 where you will find this. that we've outlined a way that we, where we think we can fund the priority one projects, and the kind of anticipated funding sources and amounts for priority one projects would be as follows: about 1.7 from property taxes in the port's annual operating budget. That would assume improvements to the port's balance sheet, though, that could include rate and fee increases that exceed the rate of inflation, as well as annual property tax increases up to the 1% levy limit. Just under $4 million in revenue bond proceeds, and this would be for the Point Hudson Jetty project. About $5.15 million from federal grant sources and direct federal funding. This is for both Federal Aviation Administration support for the repaving project at Jefferson County International Airport, as well as Corps of Engineers funding for any work that may be necessary on the Boathaven Breakwater, and of course the boating infrastructure grant that has already been obtained for the Point Hudson Jetty project. And then we're presently estimating about $850,000 from the sale of buildings at Boathaven. These would be the New Day Fisheries and Gold Star Marine buildings. And then finally, $1 million in Boathaven cash reserves, and I think that was identified as funding for work on linear dock and C&D dock.
So that's taken half the cash reserves in, isn't it?
Correct.
And keep in mind, although like the FAA grant, you know, we're pretty certain that's going to be available, but you know, we deal with other governments like the feds, and something could happen to where some of the money doesn't show up and we think it's going to show up. So,
Eric, why, I don't understand why you brought in the environmental concerns into this report. I just read what you wrote in pages 8 and 9, and it seems to me in deliberating this entire plan, what are we going to, how are we going to answer the questions that you end with here, and how will that bear, like, on whether we do the armory building or not? I mean, do we say, okay, well, because 2030 we're going to be inundated with water, we're not going to touch the armory building, it's not worth working on? I don't understand why you would even bring this into the discussion, because it's going to further complicate the decisions we have to make as to how to spend our resources.
Again, I think as it relates to the near term, it's less of an issue. It's brought to your attention because when we're talking about expenditures exceeding $12 million, many of which are, again, going to be for, well, not, I shouldn't say many of which, not all of them are generation-long life expectancies,
right,
but some of them are. These are things that that should be factored by decision makers when choosing to allocate very scarce public funds. And it does complicate things.
Like, what's an example? I mean, the breakwater, are we going to say, the Boathaven breakwater, are we going to say we're not going to deal with it because generationally it'll probably be useless anyway down the road?
I think what I'm suggesting in this section is that we need to develop some analytical approach, cost-benefit analysis, to factor the upfront cost of major rehabilitation or replacement of port infrastructure, and then the benefits to be obtained from those expenditures, and the time period within which we might be expected to have those benefits accrue. So there, as it relates to this plan, it may not be an issue, but it's something for commissions now and in the future to be acutely aware of, particularly when you're talking about major capital replacement projects or new capital projects in areas that we know will in time be inundated.
Well, our strategic plan, the 30-question matrix that's already embedded in the, our strategic plan should touch on the things you just mentioned, right?
The what?
In our strategic plan, there's a 30-question matrix, you know, 30 questions, you know, to answer specifics, you know, to benefit, that address the, you know, all seven elements of the strategic plan.
Right. Are you talking about the checklist that was developed, the following adoption of the strategic plan?
It's 30 questions.
30 questions.
Yes.
It's
not just a checklist, it's 30 questions.
Yeah, I'm aware of it. I wrote it. Yeah. And you'll recall that that was the document that I think after the commission took a look at it, the decision was taken that that was a little bit too complex and we needed to find a way to streamline that. So that's when we developed the matrix. And we developed two matrices. One matrix was for new capital projects, and that's what that checklist related to as well. It wasn't really focused on capital maintenance and replacement, but rather on carefully evaluating new port initiatives, new capital projects. So what we did was I think we went through this with the commission. We had that one more expanded version of the checklist for new capital projects, and then for last year's budgeting process, developed a more abbreviated form of that checklist, which was more relevant and related more closely to repair and replacement versus new capital projects. And that's the same matrix that we used to evaluate projects here, since we're not talking about new capital.
Okay.
So, and that's what you'll find in Appendix C.
Yeah, my fear is we've already repaired the outer break wall here at the Boat Haven, the old section that was built back in the 30s, 1934 to be exact, which is a different construction than the rest of the breakwater. It was essentially all the fill from dredging the commercial basin was encapsulated with riprap and some pilings, which have all pretty much eroded away now. And we spent, what was it, Larry, about $80,000 to fix that after that one big November storm about a decade ago. And, you know, if we believe that there is sea level rise, whether you believe it be the maximum or something less, we're already at a sea level point where with a significant storm event, we're gonna get more and more damage. So a lot of this is gonna happen long before, 2060 or whatever the projections are.
Well, it's kind of, it's what I'm curious about it. It's almost like this seems like a separate discussion apart from the document to me, in the sense, and maybe I'm wrong, but you know, okay, so going back to the breakwater here that we're talking about rebuilding, engineering, design, build, what are we going to design that for? And are we going to design that for something like this, or are we going to design it for our current conditions? And the cost of designing, how do we even come close to saying, okay, we're going to design for X? How do we even know what X is? So I guess that's my question in moving forward, but particularly with some of the large projects, Point Hudson is underway. Are we designing that for a storm surge that's going to happen potentially in 2025 that could be more significant than a storm surge of today?
They actually are. Point Hudson is going to be 2 foot higher. But remember, sea level rise is going to go right around the breakwater.
Right.
We wrestled with this question a lot when we evaluated, and I think what I came away with is dock replacement, CD docks, perfect example. We can build new 50-year docks, or we can repair the CD dock and make them last for 15 more years. That's going to be a decision you're going to make. So this plan speculates that we're going to repair CD docks, which is still very expensive. But if you decided to do 50-year docks, is that a wise investment? So those are the things that you're going to have to grapple with as far as what's going to happen 50 years from now.
But
not just us. If you look at those pictures, the whole historic waterfront downtown is in danger too. So
if I could just interject here, I think what's recommended, first of all, it's included so that it's in our consciousness and we're mindful of it, that this should factor into our decision making. And number two, I think the recommendation is that we need to take the next step, that we need to find a way to develop some sort of, this isn't going to be a black box where you feed in, information, that spits out the correct answer, but some sort of framework for consistently evaluating these projects to really better grapple with the costs and benefits.
But I'm arguing that you really don't have that framework. I mean, you can't tell me, the responsible thing to do as a public servant, port commissioner, is to build new docks for C&D, for 50-year docks, and to plan that the Port of Port Townsend is going to be here and functioning in 50 years. So if we say, we're going to put our head in the sand and we think it's not going to be here in 15 years because it's going to be underwater, how do we make that choice of, I don't think that's a very responsible way to go in terms of saying this is what our policy, this is what our policy is going to be over the next.
I would take the view that if you were talking about a, say a $5 to $6 million expenditure that you knew you would never get the anticipated useful life out of,
right,
that you would be better off taking the decision to expend kind of a fraction of that amount to extend the useful life of the facility for, say, a quarter of the anticipated useful life of a new facility, and that with the data available, that you can begin to make some more reasoned and fiscally sound decisions bearing in mind these changes that are coming down the pipe.
So is that representative of other ports that are facing the same situation?
Yes, there are particularly larger ports. I think the Port of San Diego, and I think there's some other California ports that are trying to develop some methodologies to more wisely expend scarce public funds.
The Port of Olympia looking at this real hard for quite a number of years now. In fact, we had a briefing at the environmental seminar 2 years ago. So they used Olympia as the example of, potential impacts. Mm-hmm. It's really a strategic issue. We're dealing with repair and maintenance here, but if we really think this is going to happen, and personally I do, within that spectrum, is now the time that we should be looking to invest elsewhere in our district to start developing economic jobs and revenue sources and that sort of thing too.
By the golf course.
If I may, the other thing that hasn't been mentioned yet, which should be, is that this is meant to be a living document. This is not meant to be, this is here
exactly
for 6 years and we're not going to change it.
Yeah.
Year to year, what we'll be doing is updating it and renewing it. So as more information comes in, as the projects come up that we're ready to work on, like for next year, we're only looking at two projects right now. So, but and C&D Docs is out a few years. So that would be more when we get to that point, we'll have more information, on the climate issue, and I'll have more information about the other needs of the port, and we'll address it at that time. But at this point, this is just...
That's an excellent point. This should be part of our budget process every year, mm-hmm, is going through this. Are we still okay with this as the next project? Do we want to do this instead? That sort of... analysis,
so. Speaking of this living document, there's only two copies out there, so if you could be passing those, or three copies,
yeah,
so if you could be passing those around so that other people can have a chance to look at them while we're in this meeting.
We'll share with you.
No.
Yeah, I think, Abby, thank you for making that. That's a really important point. You know, the other thing to bear in mind, too, is that I think what Harold and Larry and staff have done is, you know, to the best of our ability, assess current needs. That doesn't necessarily mean that something that we haven't thought of, haven't identified, isn't going to happen. In fact, it's very likely that such events will occur and that we're going to have to consistently update and refresh this document so that it reflects current needs. And that was really the intent, was that this would serve as sort of the framework for an ongoing capital budgeting process, annual capital budgeting process, and then our annual CIP, capital improvement program, which is reflected in the budget, would be informed by an annually updated version of this.
Keep in mind, there's a couple of projects in here that you may not do because we sell that asset.
What would those be?
No, we talked about the Gold Star building, we talked about New Day Fisheries.
Bill?
So, I guess from my cursory reading of this, this looks like a schedule of maintenance items based on condition of assets and is not impacted by regulatory demands. The example of this is that the fuel depot at the airport, which is on condition, a low priority because it has some extended life left, is likely in 2018 to become by regulatory fiat demand to be replaced. So,
yeah, we've tried to the extent that we're able to capture mandates, and honestly, the resurfacing of the runway at the JCIA is one such mandate, and that's why it's prioritized as it is because it's really non-discretionary. But we certainly would welcome any input and information you might have in non-discretionary projects that we haven't thought of and haven't captured.
That one item is, because it's as a leaded fuel facility, it's likely to end up needing to be scrapped and replaced, and that horizon on that is probably 2018.
So keep in mind, we're under contract, but that's not our responsibility. So Tailspin Tommy is responsible for redoing the fuel system. So he's leasing our system now, but if it fails or needs to be replaced, we are under contract with him to replace that. So that's why it's not a high priority here. It's not a port.
Okay, I just wondered why money would, port money was allocated even as a low priority to something that is someone else's responsibility.
Obviously, contracts, go out of stand at times.
So. I don't think there's a recommendation here that that might be allocated. Again, that project, I think, is a priority three project. What's recommended here is a path forward to fund priority one projects only.
And again, if we update this annually, I foresee a lot of these projects will shift around as the need arises. So. And the other issue is, it's always an issue with trying to do these projects. How are we going to approach a lower priority project that suddenly we get a phone call from the EDA or somebody else, Department of Commerce, saying, hey, we got $200,000 if you can spend it on this type of project. Do we now dip down and pull that project up to the top because there's funding available, although we might have to match to some extent? I see those as the standalones as they come.
So it's kind of a question for Harold and you, Eric. This, on page 17, there's a paragraph that says contingencies. And is this kind of where your environmental argument would come in? Let's say we're 3 years down the road with this document, and we're now looking at projects for the next budget cycle, and are we seeing that, okay, with, as we're seeing more and more sea level rise, that this is, this contingency of 15 to 25 is gonna cover an added cost because we have to build something bigger like the breakwater to take on?
Yeah, I mean, Harold, you can jump in here if you want. I mean, I view these as just sort of standard contingencies that would be
a catch-all.
Yeah, catch-all.
So Harold, do you think we should build a section like this that says environmental contingencies or sea rise contingencies or the world is ending?
That's too far in the future for us.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So for a six-year plan, this takes away half our reserves and doesn't give us any money to do anything except just repair stuff.
That's conditioned on a lot of things falling into place.
Yeah, like
it really does. It really does. You know, bank of.
We're demonstrating our resolve here.
It really does, beg the question, and it's a huge policy question for the commission. To what extent do you focus exclusively on maintaining a state of good repair at the port facilities versus investing in new initiatives that could, you know, potentially generate employment and improve the local economy? I don't pretend to know the answer to that. I think what we're doing here is trying to remain faithful to the strategic and focus on the basics.
Well, if there was something viable or tangible to present to compare against the expenses that are in this document, I mean, that would include a cost-benefit analysis, right?
Yeah. Again, I think what we've said in the past is for new initiatives to be viable, that they're going to have to pay their own way. They're going to have to show, the analysis would have to show that not only could the capital cost be covered, but that they were going to be a net revenue generator for the port. So I, do apologize for getting this to you at kind of the late date, and I know that it's an awful lot to serve up and expect any kind of meaningful feedback in a session like this, but I certainly do welcome the critical feedback and questions, and I'm happy to do whatever I can to address your concerns.
Is there a spreadsheet that kind of takes a cash flow look at this?
Not yet.
Projects coming in, projects being done, money coming in.
Not yet. If I'm honest, and I try to be, I kind of ran out of steam here, and the thought was that, it's so likely that there will be differences of opinion in terms of how these projects should be prioritized and what projects should occur when, that we've labeled it a partial draft quite intentionally, thinking that we would include more detail on kind of the funding plan as we get feedback.
And you asked us to bring back repair and maintenance, kind of a thing. So don't keep the messenger too much here.
Right.
it's the reality of it. And we're saddled with a lot of legacy infrastructure that, we got some big decisions to make. I guess as your director, my concern is from a strategic, this may be where we want to get the new reorganized, regenerated PSAC involved. I don't want to forgo our mandate as a port district.
to suddenly walk away from growing our economic wealth in their district and not seizing on new opportunities, one, to create jobs, but also to create new revenue streams that will help address this in the future. So somehow we've got to blend all that together and
several pronged approach.
Yeah.
This is kind of a more of a detailed one, I guess, on page 35, this shoreline stabilization study. So you have that taking place, just the study taking place in 2019. And you think that's, you don't think we should be studying that sooner?
Again, this is another one of those ones where reasonable minds can differ. We looked at kind of time-lapsed photography of that section of shoreline and reached the conclusion that that wasn't an immediate threat, and it was something that we needed to get a better information on in the near term, in the next 6 years, but that there was no imminent danger.
And the issue with that, I've taken photographs of that over the last 15 years fairly frequently, so we can see what the impact, and there hasn't been that much erosion, but it's immediately adjacent to our heavy haul-off facility. So because of that proximity, it is an issue that we at least keep our eye on.
Yeah,
so,
okay. This is awesome.
Well, there's a lot of stuff to go through here. It seems to me that we, one of the things we need to do is to be looking for new revenue sources. And putting everything into retaining the ones we have is good, because we've got to retain our existing ones, but this isn't adding anything new. And I'm not sure if we put every nickel that we have into maintaining what we have, we'll be able to add anything new. And I think we need to be able to do that.
Well, we've got to be realistic. We have a lot of facilities. Point Hudson's probably the best example. Those buildings, the community wants us to retain all the buildings and preserve them and fix them up. Well, it's very expensive. But we will never be able to charge enough rent to cover those costs. So, you know, that dollar that you spend down there, you may only get 50 cents of that back over the years. But is that something that the community values enough that it's worth doing that? I really think that we need to give the commission time to digest all this. A lot of information.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still trying to digest it, and I've had it on my desk for a week. And get it. I'd recommend we just take this draft, put it on the website this afternoon, see what our citizens and tenants have for input.
And some of it may prove indigestible.
It could be. But I think that's the reality for all local government. And I don't know what the city's doing. Again, when I look at the inundation chart, the new city hall is in that.
We tend to look at this, we kind of reduce it down to the simplest way of understanding it possible, that we're going to have these impacts and we'll need to respond to them. I think it's really useful to think about kind of the broad economic impacts to our community and region if these scenarios come to pass. The not a coherent government response to some of these issues is going to prove deeply challenging.
And the other thing is, a lot of our tenants, we've had a number of tenants approach us wanting to invest significant amounts of money into their businesses and their infrastructure on our property. And they almost need to go through the same process.
again, when you're, when, you know, when the port's entering into long-term leases, you know, 30-year leases, it's certainly something that we should be considering these issues.
Can you talk briefly, Eric, about the stormwater lift station? I should know more about that. I don't.
Yeah, I think and Larry and Harold, if you want to chime in on this, I would certainly welcome your input.
On the lift station?
On the lift station.
Well, as it stands now, our lowest catch basins are the 4 to 10 foot in elevation, and you know, with storm surge, you see 11.5. You know, so it's protected by a high gate, and should it fail, we would have drinking columns that are over catch basin. You know, so that's the current situation. As the time goes on, of course, that's going to get worse than Harold. We're thinking that we might put a lift station in so we can get rid of our stormwater regularly rather than waiting for the tide to go out. If it is now, we can't believe stormwater will plus 4 tide. So we're building a lot of water in our system up. It won't go away until the tide gets to that level. But that's kind of the best.
So the big outfall is down by the 300 ton haul out dock.
Yeah.
On the left side, 32 inch pipe. Inland just a little bit, there's a large diameter manhole. There's several pipes come together. There's two tide gates that are intended to allow flow one way only, keep the tide from backing up. Apparently they don't work very well. My experience, that's typical. And so we've got seawater flowing back into the system, which affects or diminishes treatment techniques and just causes problems like that. So the thought is that we can put pumps in that manhole, another manhole next to it, and just eliminate the gravity outfall. It looks like that's going to be 4 7.5 horsepower submersible pumps. It's just about the same size as the existing pump station we built at Emerald Marine. So it's just.
And then also repair the tide gates as well.
No, we would not need the tide gates.
Oh.
Okay. It could be taken out of the system.
We would need a backup generator. You know, obviously, bottle field.
But at high tide, wouldn't you be inundated with water? Wouldn't you be pumping out seawater?
No, the seawater couldn't get in.
Okay.
You got to plug the wall up.
Oh, I got you.
Our discharge pipes would be
up. Oh, I see. You wouldn't even use the discharge.
When that seawater gets in our system, then it ends up pumping through our RX units, our stormwater units. And being they're designed to take out metal, it's happily will take all the metal out of the salt body and just destroy $25,000 for the meeting, which is a single replacement.
This was a big issue when we cleaned our catch basins also, because it's a wet system. We had to pump out 60,000 gallons of water. If we could get rid of that water on a timely basis, we could clean the system a lot easier.
Well, unfortunately, that contractor wasn't equipped to plug the lines, and he was pumping seawater. Whereas that could have been avoided if you had had a way to seal the lines off.
Linda, did you have something?
Yeah. It's just a question. Larry.
Can you speak up?
I have a question, I think mainly for Larry because he seems to have thought this through. When we talk about the fact, especially with the seawater rising, which assets, is there an idea of what assets could be sold first? Not only save us money, but to give us the type of capital that we need to expand on high ground to generate income from a high ground level.
We have discussed some potential properties, but I think we need to spend a lot more time and really analyze that. And again, it really becomes a strategic issue. You know, where do we want to be 10, 15, 20 years from now from an infrastructure standpoint, and what we own, what we operate, et cetera. So.
Because if they're sold today, mean, they would still be operating by whoever purchased them, right? So they're not going to impact the...
Right, and we would still be getting revenue from the land lease if it was, say, we sold the building, we still, you know, lease the land underneath it, so...
But we could also sell the land, could we not?
We could, but that's, you know, that's a big decision. You know, you start selling real, you know, actual ground. And in ports, you see this all the time, Port of PA, there's just not too long ago in the newspaper, a couple articles where one of their marine trades wanted to buy several acres that are waterfront. You know, you're always hesitant in the port district to sell waterfront. You know, that is the port. And, but for all the face of those issues, questions.
The port isn't necessarily just waterfront.
No, in fact, half of the ports in the state have no water. They're industrial, rail, airports, etc.
John?
Yeah, we're, I don't know, maybe Harold or Eric could answer. Are any of the repairs being done in anticipation of a seismic event and fortifying the asset in case of a, the, what we are told is inevitable earthquake event?
And to my knowledge, there are no seismic retrofits that are proposed in this plan.
New construction incorporates that obviously by code. So.
There's no money in the budget to retrofit anything to survive the tsunami. But then, I assume.
What's interesting is, as much as we talk about the old buildings at Point Hudson, we've been told by a number of engineers they're probably the most likely to survive an earthquake event. You know, it's kind of go with the flow, but the tsunami,
yeah,
they were all dead.
Blown up to the surface.
So what do you guys think is the next step here, timeline-wise?
I think you really need to read it and come in and ask, yeah, you have questions. Give us a call, come on in, and let's talk about it and keep massaging it. And maybe throw it back on the next workshop agenda. But definitely get on the website, you know, today and get some other ideas up there. And I think our, as we restart our strategic offsites, I think we need to address this question about, is this all we're going to do for the next foreseeable future, or are we going to try to increase our revenue stream with other endeavors? Those are big questions.
Again, I would, you know, fully expect that people are going to have different opinions about how these projects should be prioritized. I would suggest that, you know, if you're mounting your own little prioritization exercise and you look at those matrices, that you try to the greatest extent possible to be as analytical, consistent, and rigorous in your assessment of the projects as you can. That's what we really tried to do as a staff, is to, you know, take the blinders off, take personal preferences out of it, and just look at the criteria and try to do our best to evaluate similarly situated projects, similar projects, through the same lens.
We didn't all agree.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we certainly agreed as to the projects that would be the highest priority. So in terms of the categories of priorities, I think there was near unanimity, but certainly as it relates, like within the rank order within priority one projects, we didn't necessarily always agree.
And then adopt this, right, as a document at some point, or?
This has to go through SEPA, so we have to go through the full SEPA process on it as a non-profit programmatic SEPA, and then it has to be a public hearing for you to adopt it. It's a process.
But sir, I think we need to wrestle it to the ground before we start the next budget cycle. Because it needs to become one of our documents every year, as Abigail was saying, that we use formulating the next year's budget.
So we'll be wrestling with this throughout 2016. Forever, but I mean, set 2016 has a year to get this refined.
Well, I think, you know, in 2016, you know, we already got the sail loft in there. We're moving ahead with the breakwater project. So some of these things are already in motion. But there might be some others that, you know, 2016 is pretty much done.
Right.
It'll be the 2017 process that will be starting in the June, July time.
So I'm curious, one of the outliers for Point Hudson is the what's called the main building. It's almost $500,000. I'm an outlier at Point Hudson. What?
Oh, the Shanghai building?
Yeah, what? What's going on with that building?
It's big. Harold, you probably can address that more than
what's the question? Why does it cost so much?
Oh, well, it's a bit of an outlier cost-wise, just because it's size, because of the roof and...
Yes, it's... You know, it's replacing the roof and replacing all the windows and doors, insulating walls, string, and floors. And I'm not sure what else is in there, but the detailed estimates are in the appendix.
That's a really big building.
You can see all the items that go into that. It's just a very large building.
So then as we go through further down the road with this, do we anticipate getting that spreadsheet pulled together, which is the cash flow year to year?
Yeah, what we would show kind of at the outset is kind of the when we need the funding and then what the implications of that will be for cash flow.
Yeah.
That also happened that the high return involved. So if you improve the Shanghai building, that you can raise the rates to cover. Is that analysis in here?
No, it's not. But it needs that needs to be part of the difference. Like I made the comment earlier, this morning, that at Point Hudson, you will never be able to raise the rates high enough to ever recoup the investment to maintain the structures. And so that's more of a political, cultural, you know, there's other things that need to go in it besides just the straight monetary aspect of it.
George?
Yeah, are the square footage lease rates that are consistent with the private sector in town?
No.
They're about the same?
They're a little lower.
They're
not much lower, like 10% lower.
Bertram?
This is a terrific document. I congratulate you for doing this. Great. It's also great that I've opened this up to the public and we can get an understanding of the commissioner's thoughts. I noticed there was a note that was passed between Commissioner Henke and you. Would you mind reading that since this is a
public? Not at all.
That was from me.
Oh, okay. I mean, this is an open meeting.
Not a problem. Steve, at some point, can you remind the audience to share the document? So that one person didn't hog it all, yeah. There's no hairy leg brought.
No Jeff Massey notes.
Okay, is there anything else? Then I think that we'll go ahead and adjourn this meeting and have our next meeting at 1:00 this afternoon.